When we started doing our fly-ins, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that, you know, it gave me a chance as a guy who'd never been there to do that kind of stuff. I mean, we've worked with different agencies and talked to different folks about things, but had never gone on a fly-in, and it was interesting how credible the individuals were and how much difference that made. But that was really driven home by to me when IRFA and ACE brought some staffers together in D.C. What was that, 2 years ago by now? And we needed somebody to come and talk to them. And so we talked to Bruce Vollen, a guy that you'll hear from tomorrow, and he was one of our speakers last year. And I was amazed that Bruce had a very short time to prepare. I don't know if Monty's here, but Monty stole most of his stuff when he was giving his remarks, so Bruce had a little less stuff to deal with. But when Bruce got up and talked, everybody in the room was silent, and they listened to every word he said because he was the embodiment of the been there, done that kind of thing. He was an example of someone who had actually done what all of those people in the room had been told couldn't be done. And so that been there, done that thing was something that was really obvious to me that we needed to do. Through our fly-ins, again, it was one of the things that struck me was how ethanol was viewed as this program, this sort of monolithic thing that was a creation of government, when I knew that ethanol is the creation of all the people sitting here. It's something that farmers grow and own and create and sell, and it's a good product that does a lot of good things. And I've spent most of my life in the fuel business, and it's done a lot of good things for me. The companies that I worked for were ethanol distributors. We had splash blending racks. We've been selling a lot of ethanol for a long time, and it did a lot of good things for our company. It also did a lot of good things for the consumers. They saved money. And the only reason they're not saving more money now is because there are people who believe in monsters in Washington, D.C. They believe that this blend wall is a real thing. And that's why this year when we did our fly-in, we brought six or seven petroleum marketers, fuel marketers, with us to tell them that they've already been over the blend wall. They've been on the other side of it. They've seen it. They didn't even see it. When Bruce was asked at the first time, they said, "What about the blend wall?" And he said, "Well, I don't know what the blend wall is. I keep hearing people say that. If you're talking about the amount of ethanol I'm selling in my fuel, then I guess we've averaged 18 to 28%, so I guess maybe my blend wall is 28. And he, last year, with the RIN prices going crazy and him applying most of the RINs that he received to the price of his fuel, his blend wall moved up to about 35 or 36 for a couple of months. So that's something, though, that we've been spending a lot of time talking with members of the administration, elected officials, anyone who will listen about what the blend wall really is. Now, you know, there's some people that will come up to you and they'll say, "Face facts." I don't mind facing facts. What I don't like facing is stuff that people made up. I don't want to face mythology. I want to face facts. And the facts are that pumps and tanks and, you know, dispensers, as the fuel industry calls them, have been compatible at least with E15 for a very long time. The challenges that we have right now, and we talk a lot about E15, we'll talk about E85. We've got our next speaker actually today. We'll talk some about E30 mid-level blends. So I'm not going to steal anything from them. But the challenges to E15 are the ones that I think we've all been focusing on and seeing most recently. And they're frustrating. There's the, you know, the number one item is the contractual. You know, a lot of our discussions just get ended because somebody says, "Well, I have a contract with XYZ oil company," and they forbid it. It's interesting because over the last 2 years, as major auto companies who sell cars in the United States have rolled out cars that are compatible with E15, warrantied for E15, and I think GM or Ford goes back to 2012, nearly every car that's been put on the road is compatible with E15 or more, according to the auto manufacturers, according to their warranty statements. And if you total those all up, those and flex-fueled vehicles, vehicles that could use E15, we're closing in on 50 million vehicles. 50 million vehicles out of a total fleet of 250. That's close to 20%. Premium, last year was the biggest year ever that cars were designed to put premium in them, and about 17% of the fleet last year had a statement in their owner's manual that says you're supposed to use premium. About 12% of the cars, the total cars, can use premium, and yet about 3% of the gas sold in the country is premium. So that means they're not following their owner's manual. But what's more important is 12% of the cars on the road can use premium, and oil companies demand that marketers put premium in their stations. 20% of the cars on the road are designed and warrantied for 15% ethanol or more, and oil companies ban E15 sales. I would say that doesn't make sense. Unfortunately, it makes perfect sense. And the issue isn't really the 5% market share. The issue is that when somebody's got to compete for that 5%, all of the other 90% has an issue. It has to be priced competitively with that 5%. Right now, gas can be disconnected from ethanol, price-wise, because there aren't enough places to sell it. And as soon as that 5% opens up, then they've got to compete for every gallon. So it's going to affect them if the oil companies don't fight it. One of the things that I'd caution us to, and it's an area of focus, when this position was created at ACE, when I took this job, one of the things that was very important to ACE was that we communicate with fuel marketers. One-to-one, if we have, you know, the story about Bill Kowser and Charlie Good is a great story because it's one guy going out talking to the other guy, answering all his questions, and then we create a guy who's going to create a lot more guys like him. That's what we have to do. I was at a seminar last week with Wayne Pump Companies. They manufacture, between Wayne and Gilbarco, they make about 90% of the dispensers in the country. And they had some fairly large marketers there. These were people from a main office. And they made some statements that were absolutely not correct. So I talked to those guys afterwards. But what I thought was interesting is after the whole thing was over, a guy from the Texas Food and Fuel Marketers Association talked to me and said, you know, you guys got to be careful with us. You know, you talk about oil companies, you talk about API. The Texas Food and Fuel Marketers are not members of API. So be very careful when you're talking about that to separate marketers, the guys who own the stations, the guys who run those, from oil companies. And so that's something I guess I'd remind us of. A lot of times station owners feel a little picked on when they do that. Now, my counter to him was, do me a favor then, change your name from the Texas Petroleum Marketers to the Texas Fuel Marketers, and then maybe we'll believe that a little bit more. But we're going to work with those guys. We continue to work with those guys. One of the other things then, along with contractual obligations, we've got the RVP issue, the summer RVP issue. It gets to be a clunky thing when you have to change. Different rulemakings, different interactions. We'll continue to keep trying to change that, but it's a real impediment. There's the liability issue. We talked about this last year. There are still people who, even if they feel like they've got full permission to do it, that have been scared into believing that they can't. We put together a program last year to talk about doing a guarantee. That's still something that's available. We haven't found the right market to put it in, and we'd still like to do that. And then there's equipment. Equipment is one that because I've been getting a lot of comments on it from groups where they just finally get to this point where they say, well, all the underground stuff has to be replaced, and that's several hundred thousand dollars. That's simply not true. We, through the BYO program that ACE and RFA do together with support of the corn growers, we have put equipment, we've asked them to evaluate some equipment. They came up with a list that showed that most stations can convert to E15 for between $1,000 and $2,500. The Wayne seminar I was at last week talked about conversion kits that will bring things up to E25 that cost $400. We worked with Davis AirTech that will do E85 compatible stuff. They have meters that range from $365, and you need two of those for a pump, to about $600. So this is all doable as far as the pumps go. But then they talk about the underground storage tanks. And when they talk about tanks and lines, there's some stuff that we've got here and I'm not going to read this whole thing, but the Steel Tank Institute has very definitive statements on their website. I think it's STI.org. These are the guys, if you make a steel tank, these are the guys who certify it. And basically what they say is we're compatible with ethanol. They don't mince words a heck of a lot. There's a Steel Facts thing, the newsletter that they put up, and up in the corner there's some stuff that I think is pretty definitive. No study has linked ethanol storage with steel tank failures. Steel has been conclusively shown to be compatible with all ethanol blends. There's not a lot of nuance to that. That pretty much says what it is. Now, you get people then who will talk about things like, if you see this list that people have, well, what about hoses, nozzles, angles, piping, pipe dope, they call it, pipe dope, which is glue. I took just a snapshot of one of these things. This comes from the specs from a company that does piping. And as you can see, the section before this talks about dry fitting the piping, putting it all together before you glue it, and then taking it apart and gluing it. There's two specs in one of those paragraphs that says, here's the kind of glue you'll use. So this isn't something, the things that they are asking of E15 would be the equivalent of somebody asking you, you know, what kind of wiring does your car have in it? What gauge wiring does it have? And if you don't know, you can't use it. You don't pick the wiring. All of this stuff, when it's put in, is done to the specs. And the specs for ethanol and gasoline blends are up to 100% gasoline or 100% ethanol. The specs are there. They've been there. In this case, there's the Fiberglass Pipe and Tank Institute talks about compatibility, and there are issues with some older fiberglass tanks and some single-wall fiberglass tanks. But they have a timeline that'll walk you through it. 1983 is the first year people certified tanks for ethanol. 1988, if you see that one, UL began listing underground fiberglass piping for 100% ethanol and methanol. 1990, they had made tanks modeled for construction to handle gasoline with any level of ethanol. 2006, the point on that is when the E85, if you guys who remember when they took E85 and said we got to take the dispensers off and create a new standard, no new standard was created for tanks and pipe because those were already covered. So they're covered. It's done. That stuff has been done. We will continue to try and inform those who need this information that the stuff that's there is stuff that'll work. We'll continue to work on all of those other items. And we would ask this one thing. We'll work with every tool we've got available to us. Any kind of program that's out there is something that we go out and make sure that people understand. Make sure that prime the pump. We want to make sure that people know that money's out there, that so that people can use it. As I mentioned earlier, we work with RFA on the Blend Your Own Ethanol program, and we get that extended for another 3 years. So we'll continue to work that. We'd ask that all of you who we've deputized and who've done a lot of work for and with ACE over the years, you continue to bring people to us who are thinking about this, who want to maybe do E15, maybe do E30, maybe do E85, and we'll continue to give them all the information they need so that we can make more places available. Because there's one thing we know. The oil industry doesn't fight this because they think it doesn't work. If E15 did what some people say it would do, we'd be the dumbest people in the world to try and get more people to use it. And the oil companies would be the dumbest people in the world to not encourage us to keep doing it. They're not trying to stop us because they're worried about engines or anything else. They want to keep control of the marketplace. And they've got a lot of money and they got a lot of power, and the fight's going to take a lot of people. But it's going to take one person, one at a time, who makes that decision, who decides to sell more, because what we found out and what we'll talk about tomorrow is that when people see that sign and they try that fuel, they keep buying it. And that's what we've got to do. That's what we've got to continue to do. So we encourage you to bring all of your friends to us who have questions about those things, and we'll continue to move this thing as quickly as we can.